Welcome to the LSE for today's event. My name is Jackie Cole Shapiro, and I'm a professor of organizational behavior in the Department of Management here at the LSE. I am very pleased to be here to welcome Professor Quinetta Robertson to the LSE today. Quinetta is the Fred J. Springer Endowed Chair of Business Leadership at Villanova University and a fellow of the Society for Industrial and Organizational Psychology. This year, Quinetta was inducted into the PhD Project's Hall of Fame that recognizes the select few who have inspired many. The PhD Project was founded in 1994 by KPMG and is responsible for the increase in the number of minority business professors from 294 to 1,470. With over 20 years' experience, her research and consultancy work focuses on developing organizational capability and enhancing performance through the strategic management of people, particularly diverse employees. She has been a visiting professor all over the world except Antarctica, and has published widely on diversity, with a forthcoming article in the Journal of Applied Psychology titled The Evolution and Future of Diversity at Work. She is currently the program chair for the 2019 Academy of Management conference in Boston, and her theme is Understanding the Inclusive Organization. Quinetta has flown in from the U.S., drawing upon her research and experiences working with organizations. She is going to challenge us to think about how we define and create work environments which value differences and offer opportunities to all. For those Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE inclusive. I would ask you to check your phones to make sure they're on silent. In order not to disrupt the event. This afternoon's event is being recorded and filmed and hopefully will be made available as a podcast subject to no technical difficulties. As usual, after the lecture, there will be a chance to pose your questions to Quinetta. But now, can you please join me in welcoming Quinetta to the LSE to deliver her lecture titled Beyond Diversity, Are Inclusive Organizations Truly Attainable?
Thank you. Thank you, Jackie. I just want to say what an honor and pleasure it is to be here at the LSE and to be able to talk about an area that I'm very passionate about. What I'm going to try to do today is weave a bit of a narrative, give you the evolution of diversity and inclusion, talk to you a bit about my research, talk to you a bit about the field and the findings in the field, and then share with you my ideas for where I think the field should go, both in terms of research and practice. I know that's a bit ambitious, but I've always been ambitious, so bear with me. And speaking of ambition, even though I haven't been to Antarctica, I feel that there's still time, right? So there's my ambition. But what I want to do first is start, when we talk about diversity, because we hear that word a lot, what does it mean? Where did it come from? And so in around 1987, there was a book that came out called The Hudson Report, and it was focused on Workforce 2000. Because that was so far away, right? Workforce 2000, and it talked about how the workforce was going to look in that year, that white males were going to become the minority, and that there were going to be more women, immigrants, and people of differing backgrounds within the workforce. And That was in 87, and then in around 1991, the same authors wrote an article for Harvard Business Review, which talked about the global workforce. And same kind of thing, they talked about changes in the composition of the workforce, but they now talked about it outside of the U.S., where the Hudson Report primarily focused on the U.S. workforce. This said that workforces in general were going to be changing. At the same time, there was a book called Beyond Race and Gender that was written by one of the foremost diversity consultants at the time, Roosevelt Thomas. And he talked about how, in order for organizations to have a competitive advantage, they needed to focus on other types of differences, because again, the workforce was changing. Now, interestingly, these three things were primarily just in what we would consider to be the practitioner space. We didn't see anything about diversity in the scholarly literature until about 1997. And it wasn't until 1997 we saw the concept of diversity, which itself was a unit level concept, which described the composition of a work group or a team or an organization. And so that became the evolution. And so at the time, when you looked at diversity in the literature, it was about composition. And in organizations, it was about composition. Who was in the workforce? Now, interestingly, I would say right around that time, I was in banking. And I was involved in the company's diversity initiative, which was to increase the number of women and minorities, or if I put it in the UK context, BMEs, in organizations. And what you found was that there were initiatives to increase the diversity of organizational workforces. But if you took a slice of the organization, you would find that the diversity was concentrated in different pockets of an organization. So for example, if you look at in the hospitality industry, if you look at hotels, hotels are some of the most diverse organizations that exist. However, a lot of the diversity exists in their cleaning staff. And so it's not throughout the organization. And so we started to see it going from what was considered the right thing to do to, you know, how can we actually experience benefits from this diversity in organizations. And the literature and practitioners both said, well, if we want to get to these benefits, we've got to make sure that we include people throughout the organization, meaning it can't just be concentrated in one area, it has to be able to move throughout. Now, after I went to, I got my PhD at the University of Maryland, and became a faculty member at Cornell. And I remember talking to people in organizations about diversity. And several people said, I have to stop you right here. We don't do diversity, we do inclusion. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, tell me about that. And they would always talk about this other construct, this other concept. And so inclusion, if we look at inclusion research, we didn't hear the term inclusion until around 99, 2000. And interestingly, one of the first places where the terminology showed up was in the social work literature. Michal Morbarak, who is at USC, she wrote about inclusion. And in particular, inclusion was conceptualized as the opposite of exclusion. And so if she drew on the work of Erminia Ibarra and others who did social networks research, who found that certain people were excluded from social networks. So how do we improve on that? Well, we have to find a way to include people into organizations or into networks. And so she wrote about it, and then probably within the next 5 years, we saw an evolution, again, of research and in practice, people talking about how can we involve diverse individuals, so people who would represent minorities in organizations, how can they have access to information, how can they be meaningfully involved in decision making, and be able to really make a contribution. So as I mentioned, I heard a lot of people saying, no, we do inclusion. And interestingly, I taught a diversity course at Cornell. And I would be willing to bet that when I had companies come and guest lecture, one of the first three slides they typically showed was the diversity of their workforce in terms of numbers, the diversity of their leadership, how many we had, their diversity of their boards, etc. And they talked about how inclusive they were. And me being a researcher, it just kept, you know, nudging at me this difference between diversity and inclusion. And so one of the first things I did in that space as a study was to try to disentangle the meaning of the two. Because one of the things that I found was that when people talked about diversity and inclusion, they talked about it as if it was one word, diversity and inclusion. Right? And so I wanted to know, was there a substantive difference between the two, or were they the same things? So what I did, I did a study where I asked various samples to give me the meaning of diversity, give me the meaning of inclusion, and they gave me different definitions. And then I asked them about the practices to indicate each. And what I found that there was a difference in people's minds about the meaning, as well as how to go about doing it, or how to create diverse versus inclusive organizations. Diverse organizations, people talked about the representation of people, members of different groups in the organization, both in the workforce or the leadership, but just throughout the organization. Where inclusion was more about that participation, more about the contribution, more about the involvement. And so what we found was that what I found initially was that there was a baseline that you had to have in order to have a diverse organization. You had to have representation of different groups. You had to have fair treatment of different groups so that each group could, you know, be consistently treated. There was a lack of bias, and they would have the opportunity to even contribute. But then once you had the diversity, inclusion was about how to draw from the talents of those differences, or how to put those differences to use. So, you know, getting people, giving them the opportunity to be involved meaningfully in the work that the organization does, be able to have access to information, be able to have members of different groups collaborate in order to get the different problem solving and innovation and creativity benefits that come from diversity. And so this, I like to think, spurred an interest in the literature as well as in practice about what are some of those practices, or how to go about creating more inclusive organizations. Now, I will tell you a quick story that I remember my phone ringing in my office after this article came out. And I answered it, and it was a very well-known chief diversity officer at a Fortune 100 company. And I said hello, and he said, "You don't get it, do you?" And I said, "Hello?" and he told me who he was, and he said, "I just read your article, and I need you to know that the world doesn't work this way." And I was, you know, I will add, I was a junior faculty member, an assistant professor, so I also had to maintain my composure and be very nice. "Thank you for your comment. Can you please tell me more?" And so he explained to me what was being done in his organization in terms of creating inclusive environments, as well as some other organizations. And I said, "That is fascinating. I would love to collect data in your organization," which that conversation ended very quickly. But he was more than willing to inform me about the types of practices that organizations need to have. And so I realized it was useful in showing the disconnect between where we were as a body of literature and what was being done in practice in organizations. Now, since then, since this article, it's been about a little over 10 years. And if you look at the literature on inclusion, inclusive organizations, it's not very broad. It's not very large at all. I'm there's been a couple of meta-analyses. I'm working on a couple of review papers. And really, I don't think I'm being conservative when I say there's about 25 articles in the management literature. So if I take HR, OB, psychology, and those literatures that are adjacent. Now, interestingly, in 2014, I had the opportunity to do a TED Talk where I looked at the concept of inclusion, and I found that there are other bodies of literature that talk about inclusion. Engineering, they talk about inclusion. Mathematics, they talk about inclusion. And we have similarities in the way we talk about it, but when we talk about practices and how to go about doing it, there's not a lot. The literature is very scant, and so there's an opportunity to expand in that area. But what we do know is that we do have some research, some findings about what are the practices and processes for inclusion. For example, there needs to be a value for diversity or for differences in and of themselves. That we see that there's, although there may be challenges, there are some benefits that come with it. That people need to feel personally valued and respected. They have to be seen as a person who can add unique value to an organization rather than as in terms of their group membership. Because that's what happens a lot of time. Someone is identified as a diverse individual, and people go to them to be the voice of that group, right? What does X group think about this? Or how would you go about doing this, assuming that there's no variability within that group itself? But so there needs to be this individual value as well, that someone has talents that they can contribute to the organization. There needs to be general systems of fairness, fair treatment. My other area of research is organizational justice. So how do you have fair outcomes and processes to make sure that they're free from bias, that they're consistent, that people have voice? That needs to be in place so that there's this standard of treatment among all employees regardless of group membership. And more recent research shows that what inclusion is about is that individuals need to have a feeling of belongingness and connectedness, that they want to feel part of a group. So even though they want that individual respect and value, that they want to feel connected to something. And that's more about them being meaningfully a part of an organization's culture and being meaningfully part of work groups. Not that, again, that they're not just there as a statistic, but they have an opportunity to be involved. And then, in order to truly be involved, they have to have access to information and have the resources that they need in order to be able to make a contribution and be able to influence decision making. In the fairness literature, we have two types of voice. We have expressive voice and instrumental voice. I often talk about it in class when I tell my students, if I want to explain the difference, that expressive voice is if when I say, I'd like to hear your thoughts, but then I go ahead and I do whatever I wanted to do anyway, or I answer the question myself, I don't take those suggestions and comments into consideration. That's what instrumental voice is, that we actually take people's thoughts and contributions and we actually meaningfully use them. And if we look at how inclusion is defined outside of the management space, it really is just about bringing something into a context. But how we actually change the context as a result of that inclusion, we don't understand as much. We're not talking about that as much. And so I'll talk a little bit later how that may be the next frontier of what we need to do. So when I look at both researchers and practitioners who study inclusion and creating inclusive organizations, there's really a focus on practices and processes. But the first diversity study that I did, my dissertation chair at the time, she and I did a study to understand people's diversity-related experiences at work. And what we did, as part of another study, we asked the people the respondents who filled out the survey, to describe two positive diversity-related incidents and two negative diversity-related incidents. And we qualitatively analyzed that information. And for those of you who do qualitative research, we had about 500 responses, so you can understand what my life looked like at that time. One of the things we found was that it was very interesting that there was a lot of variance. When we first looked at the comments, we thought, you know, what is going on here? Because people talked from things such as, you know, representation, that we have, you know, a female who is head of a certain department. And so they thought that that was important. That was a positive diversity related experience because there was a woman in leadership. But then we also had comments that said they brought us new chairs, where we thought, okay, but these are people's natural language accounts. So we had to try to understand what were the diversity-related issues that are in here, and what were they saying? And interestingly, the experiences that they recounted were able to be categorized into six areas. They talked about discrimination-related incidents, so times when there were differences in treatment or the absence of that. So we had positive and negative incidents. They talked about, as I mentioned, the representation incidents, and so there being someone of a different background or having different experiences, some other kind of group membership who was in a department, in a group, or in leadership, or the absence of that. They talked about treatment by management, so managers giving them professional development opportunities or giving them access to opportunities, or again, the absence of that. They talked about work relationships, so intergroup relations with their colleagues and other employees. They talked about respect related incidents, so that respect and value, particularly among members of other groups. That's where comments and jokes came in, and people talking to each other, the types of things that people were saying to each other, either positive or negatively. And then they talked about diversity climate. Now, interestingly, we did this study in 2006, but if I reflect back on that and I go to the results of the study, when we also looked at instances of fairness and we looked at some linguistic types of patterns, the only, out of those categories, the only category that was not statistically significant was the diversity climate category. Now, diversity climate, for those who don't know, are people's perceptions of the practices and policies of an organization. So even though there were some instances where people talked about those policies and practices, they weren't as salient as all of these other things, which were the other things were about people's experiences at work. And so when I go back to that study and now look at that data, I now find a different pattern that when organizations talk about inclusion, I find that they talk about practices and processes and practices and policies. But when people talk about inclusion, they talk about their experiences. They talk about something that's completely different. And so my thought is, how do we think about inclusion, or do we need to think about inclusion differently, where we focus more on experiences rather than on the practices that we're putting in place? But what is it actually like for people in an organization? There's one interesting study that I often reference that talks about people's experiences of inclusion, one of the only other ones that I know that talk about experience. And it was a lab study where they had people work in groups and teams, but the people who were excluded from the group in their experience actually had the feeling of being colder, temperature-wise, than the people who were included. They felt more warm, I guess, warm and fuzzy, if you will. So there was actually a somatic type of response to people feeling included or excluded, which I think is really fascinating. There are a number of researchers now who starting to try to combine these literatures. And so, again, thinking about the physical experience of inclusion or exclusion, that there's some preliminary research that shows when people are excluded that their blood pressure may go up, or they start to have those feelings, those the feelings when you have your flight or fight mechanism kicks in. Sometimes our heart starts beating faster, we start sweating a bit more, but being in a situation that is unfamiliar. And so I find the, you know, combining the diversity and inclusion literature with these other literatures, particularly on physical responses, is very fascinating. But I'm not doing that yet. I'm not going there. But again, as I mentioned, I was trying to think, how should we think about or study inclusion differently? And I was having some talks with a colleague and a friend. She was a former doctoral student of mine at Cornell, who's now a leading expert in the area of design thinking. And having those conversations with her actually started to spur my thinking about maybe there's a way that we can conceptualize or think about inclusion differently. And in particular, what struck me about it is because design thinking is similar to systems thinking, but it's considered to be more human-centric. It's more focused on experiences, of an end user's experience. Now, design thinking comes from engineering and from architecture, and so a lot of the times the end user is the customer or client. But now design thinking is being applied in other ways, particularly internally. How can we use it in order to meaningfully change organizations? And so the advent, there was a Harvard Business Review article in maybe 2007, 2008, which introduced design thinking. And it's interesting because I like to reference HBR articles because that's where you can usually start to see the disconnect between what research scholars do and what practitioners do. That's where you start to see them talk to each other, right? That's where one of the connections happens. So I often look to see, you know, the academic world meets the practical world, et cetera. But there was this initial article to talk about design thinking and what it was. And again, that there's this more human-centered way of going to change things, being a product or service or environment, but with a focus on the end user. So focusing, it's very needs-based. But then there was another article written in 2015, so almost 10 years later, and it was about the resurgence of design thinking, but it was more of a focus on design thinking and how we can apply it internally to organizations. And so I think more people started to see the need for this way of thinking, particularly because the business world became more complex, and therefore internal environments became more complex, and the ability to manage that complexity became very important. One of the things I know I talk to my students about in a leadership class that I have is the need to have the capabilities to operate in VUCA environments, high velocity, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. That acronym we used to only hear in the technology industry, but now everyone else is talking about it because it characterizes the business world in general. And so design thinking is considered to be a way of being able to manage that complexity and that uncertainty and velocity and ambiguity. And so I thought this might be something. So I started to dig a bit more into design thinking to think, could it apply? And one of the things I found in my research and reading up on it is that there are several benefits of design thinking, that it helps to shorten design processes. So thinking about as we are actually designing or changing product, services, environments, it actually shortens that cycle time. It also gives us a higher degree of accuracy for solutioning, if you will, because we're focused on the end user's needs. So rather than designing the problem without a needs-based focus, we're more likely to be able to address those needs when we use that as our starting point. That there's it helps to drive innovation. As I mentioned, there's a response to needs, and also that it helps to create a more positive experience for the end user. And so in thinking about those benefits and seeing those benefits, there were a couple things that jumped out at me, because I recently did an article where there's a lot, my background's in finance. As I mentioned, I started in banking. And And there's research that I actually love and I've done myself, which relates diversity to firm performance, right? To see if there is a relationship. Does diversity positively or negatively impact firm performance? And there's research that shows that it does. But that's a leap, right? You can't really establish causality because there's so much that goes on in organizations. So I can't reasonably stand here and say diversity helps firms improve and you don't have to do anything else. There's too many other things that go on. You know, we can't isolate all those other influences. But what I do think, if I think about all the benefits of diversity in organization, there's research on groups and teams which shows that there's innovation benefits, better creativity, more creativity, better problem solving. There's different types of benefits that come with diversity. And I thought, do these benefits translate to the firm level of analysis? And I put on my strategy hat and what I learned as a doctoral student taking strategy seminars, and stumbled on dynamic capabilities research, and found that, what made me think is that diversity does create these benefits, but if we're thinking about the firm level, it's about these capabilities that it creates for the organization. And so we talk about things like innovation, we talk about things like market access and efficiency and strategic flexibility. Well, when I think about those capabilities, they are very consistent with some of those benefits of design thinking. And so I thought this may be, you know, I had my aha moment, if you will, to think that this may be the lens through which to view how to actually change organizations and change environments in order to be more inclusive. But and then in particular, thinking about the benefit of positive experience, the design thinking focuses on the user's experience. Again, this may be the key to what we need to do. So how do we go about doing that? There, I won't, you know, go in detail about the steps of design thinking processes, but there are three primary steps, or design thinkers call them spaces, that you aren't supposed to call them steps or stages because they are not so linear, that you can start at two or three or go backwards or go forwards, but it's inspiration, ideation, and implementation. So first and foremost, if we're going to go about design thinking, we need to either define or redefine the problem, but with a focus on needs. And so, you know, as I mentioned, that used to be regarding customers or clients. But if I think about inclusion and creating inclusive environments, what are those employee needs? What are those needs of the people who work within organizations? And then once we define or redefine that need, moving to ideation is thinking, how do we actually start to design solutions to address those needs? And in order to design those solutions, or maybe it's an opportunity for change, it's not just doesn't have to be problem focused, being able to not only take the data, synthesize the data that we have, but put it into solutions, and that's not saying that there's just going to be one solution. If we're really doing design thinking, maybe we come up with different solutions that we can actually test to see which one works the best and address the needs. That's what the implementation phase is about. Being able to do that testing, that prototyping, see what works, what doesn't work, and make some refinement. And then learning from the consequences or outcomes to be able to create a better solution or change the environment in a way. That's just a very general approach to design thinking. So let me be more specific and talk about it, give you some examples of how I think this could work in designing inclusive organizations. So let's take board diversity and firm performance. That we see, there's a body of literature about board diversity and having particularly BME diversity, and the reason being because it drives firm performance. Interestingly, actually just very recently in the state of California in the U.S., there was a law passed to have quotas for gender diversity on boards. And so again, the thought is that when we have that diversity, that we're going to get that creativity, innovation, problem solving, all the outcomes that we know come from diversity. Interestingly, if we look at the findings as a collective body, they're equivocal. That we can't say definitively that there is a positive or negative relationship, that there's actually mixed findings. Well, why do we have mixed findings? We see certain things happening in boards. So, for example, there may be some research shows that when women or ethnic minorities are appointed to boards, a lot of times they have the exact same background and experience of everyone else on the board, right? And they have the same networks as well. So if you think about all the things that they're going to contribute, there's not going to be any real value because aside maybe from some kind of surface level diversity, you don't have any deep level diversity that's going to change the way the board thinks or does business. The other thing, there's some research that shows that when women or ethnic minorities are put onto boards, that they have certain subcommittee memberships that you rarely find them, for example, on the finance committee, right? And so thinking about what are the subcommittees that actually drive the board's work and what the board actually gets done, they're not on those committees. They may be more on the people committees, right? The ones that are... if we think about an organization, they aren't the revenue generating types of functions, but more of cost centers, right? People think of HR as a cost center. So what we need to think is what we, you know, if we're going to do design thinking and try to make it more inclusive, we have to think about the need. How do we recruit or obtain diversity on the board in a way that's meaningful, that it actually does drive performance or influence the work of the board? And so in getting that diversity, we may want to look for people who have different social networks and different skill sets that are going to be either complementary or supplementary to what the board already has. Another example is diversity training. I've seen changes in statistics, but I think on average, there's about 75% of large organizations that have diversity training. To me, that's like the diversity practice, right? If I ask any organization, like, do you have diversity practices? They're like, we got diversity training. It's what all the cool kids are doing. And so everyone puts it into place. But again, when we look at the research, why do people do it? They put diversity training in place because they believe that it's going to help to address bias and conflict and those types of things in organizations. But we have very little data to show that. We show that diversity training can have knowledge outcomes. People learn, but there are few findings about whether people actually change their behavior, develop skills, and whether they transfer what they learned in training to the work environment. So, again, if we're doing design thinking, if we are really trying to be more inclusive, we have to think about what is our need. And in this example, we want to design diversity training that actually responds to whatever the problem or opportunity is. So what are we trying to address? What are those skills that people need? What is the behavior that we're trying to change? And also, what is it in our context? Because what works for one organization may not work for another organization. So how do we actually design it so that it's customized to address those issues in that particular environment or those needs in a particular environment? An example for mentoring, because again, I usually have my top three practices. People usually go diversity training, they go coaching and mentoring, and they go affinity or employee resource groups. So that's usually the trifecta for diversity practices. So I feel like I can make a pamphlet. Do you want to have a diversity initiative? Here are your three practices, right? But again, for mentoring, there are... we have results that show it can be very effective, both for the mentor and the mentee. And so the mentoring relationship being successful or effective, but there's less research for the effects or the benefits to the mentor. And a lot of times it's because of the design, that there's not a lot of attention given to the mentor's experience. And so what's the return on their investment? Because they have to feel that it's meaningful, that there's also a banking terminology that I have, the WIFM, what's in it for me. So there has to be that in order for them to be meaningfully engaged and for it to work for both parties. And so we have to, again, design thinking. If we want to think about mentoring relationships have a number of benefits: sponsorship, access to information, being able to navigate cultures or onboarding people in organizations. We have to think about what's that need, what do we want, and then how do we go about designing it in a way, again, as I said, that's going to be effective for both mentor and mentee. And then finally, another example I have is best places to work, because I used to do some research on best places to work. And when you look at those types of lists, I don't know if you know how they're done, but there's usually there's three parts. There's a survey that's done for managers, there's a survey that's done for employees, and then there's usually an interview or qualitative portion. The survey that's done for employees is typically very localized, meaning they'll typically, you rarely find a random sample of a whole organization. You'll usually find the data collected in a particular department or business unit or area. So if they are having a very productive year, then maybe you may find some differences in responses. If they are, maybe that it's a good month or a good quarter or a good week or something. But there can be contextual factors. And so what best place to work lists need to say is best place to work for X group or for X industry or X business unit, because it is very contextual. If we are being inclusive, we have to remember that just because it's a best place to work for a certain group does not mean that that's generalizable to everyone and everyone in the workforce. So how do we go about designing workforces and designing environments in a way that's going to be meaningful for everyone and it's going to be a best place to work for everyone? So this is just a few examples, if I'm just doing armchair theorizing and sitting and thinking of putting it into practice, but we could come up with many more examples. But all of this to say, I need to go back to my original research question, are inclusive organizations truly attainable? I would say yes, but, or yes, and. I think that they are actually attainable, but we need to reconceptualize how we think about inclusion. And thinking about making an inclusive organization may not be so much about the practices and the policies, but we've got to focus on the experiences. We've got to start with the needs of our end user. So thinking about our employees, thinking about our students, thinking about our clients and customers, because diversity has effects there, but we have to think about what's the needs of that end group that motivates the problem or the opportunity. We actually have to collect data, qualitative, quantitative, but try to understand what those needs are, understand what that experience is, and use that in the design of the solution. A lot of time, it's the HR folks, or it's the diversity folks, or it's someone in the organization who is doing the design without understanding the needs of the group who it's being designed for. So how do we actually do that to generate solution alternatives? And then we actually do have to test those different solutions or those different practices. It's not plug and play, right? That it's just because we have a certain practice or policy doesn't mean that it's going to work. We have to see how do we either change it so it can work, or we have to design a new solution. It's an iterative process. It's not a final scenario or solution. But I think if we do that, then while we may not actually reach the end point, we may get closer to building more inclusive organizations. And so me being goal-oriented, I'm doing some future thinking and having my title for when I come back in a few years that's called Beyond Diversity Designing for Inclusive Experiences at Work. And so hopefully, you know, we've started doing more of that and we can have a better understanding of what that actually looks like. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the lecture, Quinetta. We'll now open the floor to questions from the audience. So if you can let us know your name and affiliation and wait for the roving stewards to come with a microphone.
Hi, Quinetta. Thank you so much. That was a great talk. My name is Olivia. I'm from New Financial. We're a capital markets think tank and forum, and we work with the Treasury on the Women in Finance Charter in the UK. So we measure how financial services firms are moving towards their targets. My question for you is just around anthropology and its role and contribution, the contribution it can make to this literature. Have you seen any? What has it told you? Thoughts on that would be really appreciated.
That's such an interesting question. So I have been talking to a few people today and about the findings in the diversity literature. And when I say that, I'm being very, very general, because you'll find that there are people in psychology who study diversity, and people in sociology who study diversity, and people in anthropology, and none of them talk to each other, right? And so you have very discrete findings in these literatures. And one of the things I'm trying to do is see if it's possible to synthesize some of this so that we understand what the body of findings is. And if I think about anthropology and the way anthropologists go, their methodologies and the way they go about studying a phenomenon, I think the fact that they study human needs and also those needs in particular contexts, I think that would help to inform a lot of this research in psychology and sociology, because a lot of the findings in those areas account for context as a moderator, but as a moderating variable, I should say, rather than actually qualitatively or meaningfully understanding the features of a context and how that might be changing needs or changing the inclusion or whatever the phenomenon is. So I think that there is there's a particular value the way anthropologists go about doing their work that can help to inform the field.
Third row, person with the striped t-shirt.
Hi, thank you very much for the talk. It was amazing. My name is Daniela, and I'm studying a master's in philosophy and public policy. So I guess my question is a very vague question about numbers. So when thinking about the sort of philosophical aspect of things like affirmative action and quotas, I always wonder whether or how that relates to the actual practice of, for example, quotas. And thinking about inclusive organizations, I guess I'd like to know what your view is on, for example, is there a point where an organization becomes inclusive? Because I think looking at the qualitative aspects of how organizations are inclusive is really important. But whether you see things like quotas as damaging because they, you know, once you have 10 or 11, you're done. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, is there a point? Is there a way we can get around organizations thinking of inclusion as fulfilling, you know, ticking a couple of boxes or getting to a point and then stopping?
Mm-hmm.
Stopping.
I have to organize my thoughts around this. Let me first take my experience in the U.S. is that there was affirmative action law that in some instances was done incorrectly. So they said, we're gonna have quotas and hire members of certain groups. We don't care about some organizations said, we have to do quotas. We don't pay attention to the experience or the background or the qualifications, which made it have a stigma attached to it. And you found then some people started using diversity as a word just because affirmative action had a stigma. And so it wasn't so much, so some people replaced it, but then other people said, you know what, we know that it's the right thing to do to make sure that there are a member of different groups represented here. But in the study, one of the studies, I did a study looking at, as I mentioned, people would come into my class and tell me about the diversity of their board or their leadership. So I did a study to find out if that actually matters. And there was a curvilinear U-shape so that as diversity increased, performance declined. But there was a tipping point where at a certain number, there was a critical mass that there started to be a positive impact on performance. And what it suggested was that this isn't very scholarly, but I call it the we got one phenomenon, right? And so when some organizations, they get one or two, they got one, right? They got two. And the value becomes just that. And the way you can see this, quick little tip, those are the people that are always featured on the website. You know, those are the people that they always interview, et cetera, because they, look, we've got the diversity. But what you find is that if you check in with those people at time T plus one, they're no longer there. Because they realize that, so that you never, everyone, there's big fanfare, come to my organization, there's these recruitment pushes, and then they get there and it's not an inclusive environment or doesn't value that diversity. So the person becomes disengaged, disenfranchised, and they realize that their value is being pigeonholed. And so what happens? They leave for a better offer. They become very susceptible to poaching or if another organization, you know, recruits them, etc. And so one of my questions as a result of your question is what's the causality? Does inclusion drive diversity or vice versa? And it may just be this kind of cyclical, you know, this mutually reinforcing system. But I think there's a lot to unpack there. But I do think at the very least, you have to have fairness and the absence of discrimination so that people have the opportunity to be there. But then in being there, having that representation, it has to be meaningful or important that they're actually involved in what the work is of the organization. And in order to do that, there has to be a certain climate or culture in order. So again, I think what I am arguing for, I'm probably hypothesizing it, but it needs to be tested.
The person in the check shirt.
Hi, thank you for the talk. It was very insightful, really interesting. My name is Aaron Spivey. I work for a corporate sustainability consultancy, and I graduated from LSE as well. My question is kind of about siloing in the workplace. So we work with companies who obviously have HR functions and then procurement functions and core strategy teams. And if we're giving advice on an issue such as something like diversity and inclusion, often these kind of issues sit with specific teams. So let's take HR, for example, where this would usually sit. And that HR team will have their own kind of background, their own thoughts on how to do this, their own internal politics of how the HR team is seen across different arms of the business. What would your kind of suggestions be as to how to make sure that this kind of thing isn't siloed and how it does get the buy-in from leadership? Because I think tokenistically a lot of leaders do kind of want to be on board with this, but there's so many other sorts of factors and reasons. And I really liked the piece when you were talking about financial implications and company performance, because that's growing and as a field, I think that is something that people are looking to. But it needs to be, as you say, beyond that as well. There needs to be this thinking. So how would you, to cut the question, how would you basically encourage this to not be siloed into certain areas and to really grow throughout an organization?
Yeah. So I think there are people who would say, this is not my answer, this is like the first step in my answer, but there were people who would say you need champions throughout the organization. And so it can't be just localized or siloed in one place, like in HR, that you have to have it throughout the organization, and those champions have to have the ability, either the position, the title, the responsibility, in order to affect change. But if I tell you about my experience, when I am working with companies, if they know that there's someone coming in to talk about HR or diversity and inclusion or something like that, I know that I've got 15 minutes max of their attention, right? They're thinking, and I can say this because I used to be a finance person, so when they told us we had a meeting with HR, I'm like, I already know how much I make and what days I have off, right? Why do I need this? But I'm a convert. I study HR. I do it now, so I can say this. But I could already see them like this, right? But what I don't start talking about HR, diversity, inclusion. I start talking about the bottom line. I start talking about top line growth, you know, revenues. I start talking about bottom lines. I start talking about whatever their margins are. I've done my due diligence to understand how do they determine their effectiveness. What are their key performance indicators? And then I talk about how people drive those. And so usually when I started about talking about the bottom line or the KPIs, they're like, continue. Because they don't expect the HR person to be able to speak their language, right? And so being able to do that, then talking about people, they're like, huh, continue. And then I get to the diversity and inclusion. And I would say 90% of the time they say, I've never thought about it this way. And so part of it is them for them, and I think for managers and leaders in particular, to understand how it relates to their bottom line. Again, the what's in it for me. Because when they do that, they can then see it's not a standalone thing or initiative. I am not doing diversity or doing inclusion, but I'm actually doing something that's driving my effectiveness. And usually after that talk, I say, you know, call me back if you want to talk more, and they call me back because they're saying, now how do we go about doing that? And that bottom line argument can apply in any environment. I have done work with universities, and they say, we don't have a bottom line. And I say, you do. But it looks different than a for-profit company, right? One of the studies I found in education is that the amount of money or contributions that alumni make are based on their perceptions of their experience with staff at the while they were at the university, not with faculty, which makes me feel very bad. But, you know, we think, but we only see them 3 to 6 hours a week. We're staff. See them more, just staff in total. So thinking about how to have staff members who are able to interact or be inclusive is very important. And that helps to drive that university's outcome. When I say that at a college or university, they're like, oh, we never thought it that way. So it's always, that's what I try to do is frame it as a bottom line argument and then get to now the how or the specific about the people.
We have two final questions. Three, four, five, six. Okay, let's start at the front. It's seven. Let's start at the front. Second row.
Thank you for the interesting talk. Emma Soane from LSE. I'm interested to hear how wide you think the concept of diversity is and whether what you've talked about applies to things like personality or the way that people will approach different thinking because they have a different way of seeing the world, broadly speaking. And I've heard a few people on board saying, we've done what you've described as the we got one.
Mm-hmm.
But they've said, actually, we all think the same. So we're not actually bringing any diversity of thought or innovation to the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that some of the things that you've talked about apply more broadly. So mm-hmm. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think, so interestingly, when I talk outside of the U.S., I don't use diversity as much because I found, particularly in certain places, it's considered to be a U.S. export, the terminology. I've actually been in other countries and people say, we don't have diversity. And I'm like, okay, but what they're saying is the way you think about it, right? And I think a lot of times, particularly in the U.S., people go to the laws, race and gender. But I think, to your point, there's diversity of thought. And you can't extrapolate and say that gender or race is going to be a proxy for diversity of thought. And so there's this deep level diversity. So what I usually encourage people to do is to think about, if they think about people working together, work groups or people thinking about work teams and when the work process fails, when they don't collaborate effectively, why not? and getting under what are those fault lines. And a lot of times those fault lines are something we can't see. And so I think it's important for organizations to understand their context and understand what those fault lines are. Because it may be personality. It may be someone's, I was working with an organization that all the leaders had either a background in finance or engineering. Well, it's because they were an oil company, and that's the background. Most people came from finance or engineering. So if you could speak finance or engineering, you got ahead. So thinking about that as a dimension of diversity, that functional background. So I do think we have to think about it more broadly, and that's why I like the design concept, because not only does it go across contexts, it goes across cultures, it goes across industries, but it's basically saying in identifying the needs, you have to understand your workforce or understand your environment and where that diversity is, because it may not be as simplistic or as categorical as we've thought about it. So yes.
The person in the navy blue shirt, fourth row back.
Hi. I'm an LSE grad and also work at a startup. Mm-hmm. We're pretty small. We're kind of 25 people. I think, you know, it's really important for us at the moment to actually, because we're looking to grow, to actually get things in place now so that as we grow, things are already in place and we already have an inclusive culture, mm-hmm. as opposed to kind of looking back in a year when it's toxic and thinking what went wrong.
Right.
What would you say are the things, obviously, you know, we're light on resource, we haven't got kind of huge data sets to play with. What are the things, you know, maybe kind of the three or four things that you think that we can consider in our position that could put us in a good stead,
yeah.
sort of a year or two down the line?
So I think that first, again, identifying the need, what's particular to that context. And a lot of times there's already data available, be it an employee survey or something, to get some indication about what are those things that keep people engaged and what are those things that disengage people. And that's saying on an individual or, again, collaborative basis. Understanding that would help you understand what needs to be in place. So, for example, I'll give you an example of a startup recently I was working with. They were thinking about how do we get people diversity in the organization in terms of gender and race? And that wasn't the issue because they actually had diversity. But where they had the challenge was as people were being on teams, on project teams, you found the same teams working together time and time again. And it wasn't because of their knowledge or background. They got to self-select onto teams, and people just gravitated to the teams where they knew people or they were used to working with people because it just made it easier, right? Because that's fewer meetings you have to have because we know each other, we know the way each other thinks, so we just have to check in. And so they actually had to make it a point to build in conflict and debate by mixing up the teams. So people who didn't work together traditionally to build teams, to create teams differently, and then to have training on how to be a team member. So how do you elicit, how do you get those viewpoints out? How do you have people communicate? How do you resolve conflict? Those kinds of things. And that for them, because collaboration and innovation was their bread and butter. That was value creating for them. And so being able to reconfigure those teams helped to actually drive their outcomes. So that's just a quick example because I know I'm giving these long answers. So
we have a number of questions left and only time for one more. So
this guy in the back I don't mean to turn, but I just saw him like...
Thank you a lot.
And he stood the whole time, so...
Better be a good one, right? Thank you for the last hour and a bit. It's been fantastic. I work for an advertising company, and diversity inclusion is a big subject within our industry right now. And myself and five others, one of the other guys down the front there, set up to try and be kind of the benchmark of what a diverse and inclusive agency looks like. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, most of our work is insight and creativity, but we're getting big corporates come to us now and ask for help in how they become more like us. Mm. And I guess one of the big challenges is they've created cults where they've kind of employed people to think and be like themselves rather than think differently. So you're, one of the things I took out is kind of focus on the experience and, you know, what are the needs of the end user. If those end users aren't there because they're all thinking the same, but there is a senior level sponsor that says we need to change because otherwise we're going to go out of business, are we bringing best practice, or is there a different way to kind of bring that out of the organization themselves?
Yeah. Interestingly, I just got appointed to the advisory board, a diversity advisory board for an advertising firm. We're starting to have these conversations. But I think there's two things in there. One is that when people are in that cult that you describe, they rarely know they're in a cult, right? So you have to show them that they're in a cult. And how do you do that? Is one of the easiest ways is to show them a decision that needs to be made, right? So we've got to come up with a pitch for this, or we have to, you know, whatever the work is, we're going to do this, and ask them to do it. And then reflect on the alternatives. Why did you do it that way? Why did you say it this way? So, and that's what I do with in leadership development with managers. I'll say, here's a sample of, you know, tell me out of your employees, you got to promote one. Who's it going to be? And they'll say, this person. I'll say, okay, why? Because usually it's someone just like them. And they say, I don't know. They just have that something. And this something usually means they remind me of myself. Right? And so getting them to get to the objective performance. So now tell me why that person, objectively, give me behaviors, results, etc. But tell me why not these other people. And just by getting them to do that reflection and on their own judgment and decision making helps for them to realize that they need to have maybe a different way of going about the work. Which then takes me to what I've seen in advertising firms and firms that have creativity as their business. There's typically not a best practice, but a best process. That the way you go about brainstorming and understanding becomes very different. I think another industry or environment, pharma companies do it as well. They have this way of that R&D process that if other organizations use that, they would get to those better outcomes and they would break the cult because they're too focused on the practices rather than how we're going about actually making decisions and doing the work itself.
Quinetta, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here, and I'm confident that everyone will have been inspired by what you said. Thank you very much for taking time out of your very busy schedule, flying to London. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.